Good morning. John and I were really excited this morning that we get the handheld mic, because John always says when he gets the little fancy one like Steve has, that he either feels like a Backstreet Boy or a pastor, and he doesn't know which one is worse. So I just stole his joke, and therefore you should forgive him when he's not funny. So as Paul said, we're John and Susie. We work for Delete Freedom Network, and we have the immense privilege of taking a few of your youth to India this summer to see what God is doing there and how they can be a part of it, and to report back to you about how you guys can be a part of it. So we're very excited about that. John and I have been in relationship with DFN for about 3 years. John was the youth pastor at North Shore Alliance Church, and we did a very similar thing where we started a few fundraisers, and we eventually took a youth team of our own. So we spent a lot of time near DFN staff hearing about what was happening in India and just feeling our hearts growing for this group of people who we knew very little about to begin with. They approached us and said, we would love for you to be on staff. We feel that you would be a good fit with our team, but we can't pay you. So it took a while for us to get to a place where that worked for everybody, and we committed to raising our own support, and we've now been on staff with DFN since December 1st. And we spent the first 4 months in India, from December through to the beginning of April, visiting different projects that have been funded by Canadian churches, businesses, individuals. And now we're back here, being advocates and telling the story and writing and reaching people and trying to encourage people to be a part of something bigger. So, who are the Deletes? I know that your church has begun a partnership with DFN, and so some of you are probably aware, but I'll just give you a brief introduction. As the video said, there are about 250 million people in India who are told that by birth they have no place in the caste system, that they are worth less than animals, and they are treated accordingly. So they are denied access to all the things we take for granted. They're not allowed to go to temple, they're not allowed to go to public school, to public parks, they're not allowed to drink from public wells. They are isolated and oppressed in every way possible, and as a result, they become more susceptible to things like child trafficking, sex trafficking, bonded labor, because they have no legal or educational knowledge and therefore no way to fight back. People always ask us, well, how do you know someone is a Dalit? And we say all the time, if you have been told and your family has been told for 3,000 years that you are worth nothing and you have been treated like that, that's enough to break a person's spirit. And you can see when you interact with someone and they have been told over and over that they have no value, you can see that in the way that they carry themselves. And our goal at Delete Freedom Network is to see that broken, to see these people freed. We're doing that through a number of different ways. Most significantly is building elementary schools. As of June, we have 100 schools across the country. We also have vocational training centers where women are taught to sew, do things that give them a viable income. We have healthcare. We have all different kinds of ministries that are reaching out to these people, meeting their needs, sharing hope and love and light with these people. So it is obviously a huge privilege to work for that kind of organization. I'll give you a brief overview of what we did when we were there. We visited 21 of the schools, did a number of things, very formal things like writing government reports for Revenue Canada to say, yes, this money went to a real school, it really is there, it didn't end up in someone's pocket. Wrote lots of reports. But more than that, we were there to see, to learn more, to be able to bring the stories of pain and the stories of hope home. And we were also there to encourage, to tell the teachers and the doctors and the nurses and the sewing teachers that they are transforming India for God's glory and that we are cheering them on loudly from Canada. So we are going back to India in 50 days, team, 50 days, with six of your teenagers and Paul in April. And just to give you guys a little bit of information about what they're doing, we're going to be visiting four different schools, two for a day each, and two for 3 or 4 days running summer camps. Just blessing these kids extravagantly, letting them play with felts and soccer balls and styrofoam and things that are completely foreign to their landscape, allowing them to be creative and energetic and just to release some of who they are. We're going to teach them songs and dances and just let them have a childhood that really has been stripped from them. And what we keep telling the team is, we're going to go with all these great ideas. And when there are 500 kids at our camp, they're all going to fall apart because you just can't play duck, duck, goose with 500 kids. But in our minds, none of it matters. None of what we do matters. If we go love these kids, if we go touch kids who've been told they're untouchable, if we eat from the same plate as people who've been told anything that they come into contact with is contaminated, if we tell them about a God who created them equal and has not forgotten them and has a purpose for them, in my mind, we never need to play duck, duck, goose. So we would love to see you guys just get around this team to empower them to know that they are, as we sang in that last song, the generation rising up to take their place, to go around the world to fight for justice. And I would just like to say that I'm tremendously thankful that we get to share on a morning where Miss Natalie also got to share, because I find often we come and we speak about India and how raw and broken it is and how much need there is, and people go, that's great, but I'm never going to go to India. And John and I feel very passionately that there is as much need here, be it on the downtown east side or in Wally or in Tawasin or in North Van. So I'm really glad we got to hear about a local missions. Yeah, okay. I'm going to share with you a few stories that were devastating to us and a few stories that were very hopeful to us, just to give you a glimpse of sort of what we saw every day in India. And then John is going to preach more than I am. One of the things I saw in India is how subtle discrimination can be. There is very big picture discrimination where these Dalits are forced into a certain area of the community and they're denied access to all these things that I listed at the beginning. But some of the discrimination and the dehumanization was so subtle and manipulative that it was just nauseating to me. We heard one story from a man, Sukant, who's actually a very high up leader in DFN, an unbelievable man, so generous, so thoughtful, so good to John and I. And he's a Dalit man, and he told us a story of when he was a teenager. He had been out, and he was walking back to his village late at night. The sun was setting. And on the other side of the road were three upper caste women who had just walked several kilometers to get water for their families because there was no well in their village. And they're carrying these huge cisterns of water on their heads, kilometers back to their village. And Sukant, on the other side of the road, his shadow is falling quite far because of the sun, the time of day, and it crossed them as he passed by them. His shadow touched them, and these women immediately stopped, took the water down, poured it out, and turned around and went back. Because in their minds, the contamination, the degradation that would occur to them if they drank this water that had come into contact with something so filthy was not worth it. And they turned around and went back. And Sukant told us this story. He's now 40. I mean, this was probably 25 years ago. And the shame in his eyes telling that. These people are broken. They are lied to. And they are hurting. They are hurting people. Another story we heard, as in many places in the world, girls have the short end of the stick, and even amongst the Dalits, the women, the girl children, are discriminated against more than the boys. And we visited a village called Ghataprabha in the south of India, and someone was very graciously giving us a tour of their village. And he was walking around, and he was saying, this is where the cows stay, and this is where the village chief lives, and this is the filthy river where we get our drinking water and wash our clothes, and this is the tree with poison leaves that we feed baby girls so they die and we don't have to raise them, and this is the street that leads to the market. And just as a part of the scenery of his village, he explained to us that when people give birth to girls, the social stigma for them is not worth it, and they would rather commit infanticide then have to raise these girls and pour in money and energy to someone who ultimately is going to marry and leave their family and not help them out in any way. And the stories we heard of the oppression and the mutilation and the sale of girls really did make us sick, sick to our stomachs. John has a 4-year-old sister. The idea of selling her or abusing her or for us was probably one of the hardest things we struggled with the whole time we were in India. And for me, as a woman, it meant a complete reevaluation of where I see myself in the world. And I think I had always considered myself to be free and equal, having grown up in North America, but I never really had understood how privileged I am to have gone to elementary school. Most of the women we were encountering never had the opportunity to go to school and cannot read or write. We heard story after story of little girls who had died because their parents would not take them to the doctor. If the son was ill, they would, but if the daughter was ill, often in the villages, they didn't think it was worth the expense. And I came to this realization very abruptly that my parents thought I was worth it. When my brother and I both had chicken pox, we both went to the doctor. We both got medicine. I realized that as a woman, I occupy a very unique place in the world to be university educated, healthy, married by choice to a man who respects me, earning the same salary as him. And it was very unsettling to realize how privileged I am, we are, and then to be interacting with people whose lives are so different, whose lives I will never fully understand. The last story, a very subtle discrimination, is one I cry every time when I tell, but I'm going to try and hold it together. One of the Canadian schools is called Sirsila. It's right in the middle of India, about 3 hours from our head office in Hyderabad. And we visited the school, saw these joyous kids, visited all the surrounding villages, seeing the power of education, how these kids' lives are being transformed. And we got to sort of the farthest village away from this school that you could still consider to be in the catchment area, if you will. And it was the poorest village we had ever seen, just very ramshackle, makeshift homes. We actually showed John's sister a picture last night, and she said, "Why is there so much garbage?" And we said, "That's their homes." And she said, "Well, why do they live in garbage?" And we said, "Because garbage is free. You can build things out of it." And she just could not understand that. So this group of people was a tribe who were previously nomadic, and the government 3 years ago forced them to settle. And they gave them land, and they've guaranteed them 150 working days a year. So this has been an easier transition than it could have been, but still a huge one for a people who previously were moving quite freely. And we started chatting with some of the adults in the village, and they were telling us how one of the upsides to now living in a permanent location is they, for the first time, can send their children to school. And these kids are the first generation ever of this tribe to be educated. And these parents made a courageous decision to say, our kids' futures are going to be different than ours. But it's too far for them to go to the DFN school, and so they're going to the local government school, which sadly does not do a very good job. And they told us that their kids are not allowed to sit with the other kids. All the upper caste kids sit at desks and they get books. And the kids from this tribe have to sit on the floor. They're not allowed to look at the books. They're not allowed to touch the other kids or eat with the other kids. But what broke my heart was they told us that the teachers will not even degrade themselves to beat these children as punishment because they don't want to be polluted by touching these kids. So they stand at the front of the classroom and they throw erasers and rocks at the kids so that they can humiliate and punish them without dirtying themselves. And to me, watching these parents say, we are trying to free our children and this is how we're being treated, we said to them, you have to send your kids to our school. We will give them books and uniforms. We will sit them in the front row with all the other kids. We will love them. We will treat them the same. We will change that stereotype. We will free them. And they said, we can't get there. There's no way for us to get there. So we left that school just crying. And we wrote a letter to everyone we knew, and we said, this school needs a bus. And the first week we came home, someone bought a bus. probably told this story 15 times and I cry every time. So sometimes we get people who say to us, you know, Christians who say to us, I don't want to be a part of it unless it's, you know, I'm distributing Bibles or building a church or doing something very nominally Christian. And I say to those people, that bus is the gospel. That bus is going to let those kids be treated as equals. That bus is going to transform that village. Thank you. So, hope is very real. It's very tangible. It comes in all sorts of ways. Sometimes it's yellow and looks like a school bus. But we saw hope being lived out in so many ways. And what we left India feeling, more than rage, more than desperation, more than sadness and anger, was hope. These kids have the right to dream of a future that is different than their parents. And seeing the difference between kids in a village and kids in the school is unbelievable. You would ask a kid in a village, we would go into their home and we say, what are you going to do? What do you want to do? And when I was five, I said, I'm going to be a ballerina and an astronaut and a whatever. And these kids would say, oh, my dad's a fisherman and his dad was a fisherman and his dad was a fisherman, so I will be a fisherman. And the kids in the school, we would ask them, and they would say, I'm going to be a cricket player. I'm going to be a Bollywood star. I'm going to be the president of India. I'm going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And in my mind, whether they achieve those dreams or not is frankly irrelevant. The fact that they believe they can, that they're growing up in a society that is shifting enough that they can be allowed to think that way, that is hope. And we talked to parents who said, I can't believe my kids are learning English. I can't believe my kid can read and write. I can't believe my kid comes home singing songs in English. English is the language of the rich and privileged. I can't believe my kid is learning that. And the pride in their faces of saying, my kid is not going to live the life I live. That keeps us going. When we have those hard moments to see those parents say, my kid's going to have a new future. We're seeing women who have been so battered thrive as they are empowered. We heard one story at a school called Nandigam, which is where most of that video was filmed, which is one of the schools we're going to with the team. She was widowed, which lessens her status even more dramatically. A woman without a man in her life has no rights whatsoever. And what's more, once her husband died, she was returned to her parents' home, which is a huge shame. So she has all this stigma attached to her. And what's more, her husband died of HIV, so everyone suspects that she's probably positive as well. And it's just like every negative thing you could possibly do to a person's reputation has been piled on top of this woman. And she was given a loan by one of our schools, Nandigam, and her dream was to start a bangle shop with the bracelets that all the Indian women wear. And there is no other bangle shop in this community, so people have to go to her shop. And she's all of a sudden offering a service to them that they need and want, and she has the pride of saying, I'm providing something, I'm earning my own money, I'm no longer dependent on my parents, I'm able to feed my child myself. And she's now coming to a place of saying, why? Why would you do this for me? Why would you pick me out of the dirt, literally, and give me this and change my life? And from there, we're able to begin a conversation of, because we don't think you belong in the dirt. We don't think you were created dirty. We believe there is life in you. We believe in a God who made you, and we want to call that out of you. Over and over, we are seeing Dalits being empowered, being transformed, blossoming. And every day, it is a privilege to be a part of that, to be a part in a very small way of fighting for the freedom of these people who the UN has declared are facing the greatest human rights violation on Earth. 250 million people. That's almost the population of the United States. That's way more than the African slave trade ever numbered. And yet we don't use words in 2010 like slavery and apartheid and racism and discrimination, but they are rampant in India. There's a song by Brooke Fraser, who also wrote Hosanna, that says, "Now that I have seen, I am responsible. Faith without deeds is dead." And that is what we are trying to live every day. We have seen this. We cannot go back to living in complacency and apathy like so much of our culture has. We are going to fight for this. This is what God has called us to. This is our fight now. So we want to say thank you to you as a church for what you have already done in your partnership for DFN, for rallying around their team. Their fundraising has been unbelievable. John and I have taken probably half a dozen missions trips, and we raise our own salary, and fundraising is a pain. And the only reason they have done so well is because you guys have rallied around them. So thank you for believing in them, for believing in Delete Freedom, and for being willing to partner with us.
Not quite sure what's left to say, to be honest. Except it's really frustrating every time my wife tells that story, because my whole manly macho thing just goes out the window as I'm sitting there weeping. So it's frustrating when she does that, because I can't quite keep up the image that I try to keep up so often. Sarcasm, by the way. You're allowed to laugh if you want. You don't have to. No pressure, but I feel like sometimes I have to kind of put that out there, because if people don't know me and then I talk, they kind of are like, what is this guy doing? So here we are. What a pleasure it is to be with you. And I promise I won't take too long, because I'm sure we all have lots to do today, praying for sunshine. But I feel like there's an important thing that God is doing right now in the church. And when we were in India and we saw these things and we experienced all these stories and we saw brokenness so evident and so clear, something happened to me. And the only way I can really describe it is just a big fat slap in the face. And God, not so gently, asked me questions like, John, what are you living for? What is the point of your faith in Vancouver, in North Vancouver? When you see things like we've seen in India or in Wali or in Malawi or whatever it is, when you see people suffering, questions like that come and you're asked, what are you living for? And as I open my Bible in the context of sitting next to a Dalit person, an untouchable, living the life they live, and I began to read through who Jesus says that he is and the things that he proclaimed and what he was about, I was shocked and amazed. Over 2,000 times is poverty mentioned in this book. I heard a great story once of a professor who was teaching at a Bible school who took a Bible and cut out every single passage that had anything to do with poverty and justice. And he took this Bible to his class and he held it. He turned it upside down and all these little pieces of paper fell out. Then he was standing there holding this thin little book and he says, "This is the North American Bible." And I heard that, and I was like, wow, what are we missing in our faith? What are we missing that Jesus talks about? How do things that happen on the other side of the world, how does poverty and injustice affect me here in this world? What does Jesus say about that? Matthew 25, clearly, he has words for us. Matthew 25, verse 34 says this, "Then the king will say to those on the right," this is just after he's divided, telling a story about dividing the sheep and the goats. He says, "The ones on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty, and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me into your home. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you cared. I was in prison, and you visited me." Then the righteous ones will reply, "Lord, when did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked and care for you? When did we ever see you in prison and visit you?" And the king will tell them, "I assure you, when you did it to one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you were doing it to me." about 4 years ago, Susan and I were passionately ready to go and move to Rwanda to join with Youth for Christ working in Rwanda with their ministry there. And the director of YFC Rwanda came to Vancouver, and we were sitting on Grouse Mountain, and he's this massive, big African man. And the culture in Africa is a little bit different. Same in India, where men kind of interacting intimately is a normal thing. So you were walking there, tons of tourists, lots of people, and he walks up beside me and he just grabs my hand. And away we go for like an hour, walking around this top of this mountain, tourists everywhere, giant black men, little me, walking around. And he said something to me and to us as we were interacting with him, and he says, "It's great that you want to go across the world and love people. It's great that you feel God saying, go and be about my mission, about my kingdom. Go, go, go. But are you willing to do it in your own city?" And in that moment, I heard Jesus say to me, "Are you willing to come and find me? Are you willing to come and find me in the least of these, in your own city?" And maybe that's a question for us today. Are we willing to hear the call of God? To be about his kingdom, to be about his business, and to go to the least of these, to go to those who are suffering in our community. It doesn't have to be suffering and poverty. There's many types of poverty, not just financial poverty. There's emotional poverty, relational poverty. There's all sorts of people out there who are in need of someone filled with the life of Jesus to come and speak truth to them, to come and love them unconditionally. That was a slap in the face for me. Yes, go to India, go to Africa, do all these things, great. But if you cannot love your neighbor, what's the point? And I know sometimes our neighbors are the hardest people to love. Eccentric, crazy people. But there's a call from God that says, love me, love your neighbor. What are we willing to fight for? What are we willing to put our time and energy into? This might sound a little bit shocking, but I want to share this with you. And please hear the whole statement out. Don't just cut me off after the first line. The church is not the savior of the world. Jesus is the savior of the world. The church is not the light of the world. Jesus passed that on to you, to me. And fortunately enough, we actually make up the church, so that's kind of fun. But if we are willing to live that life that he's asked us to live, if we're willing to really believe that Jesus' call to follow him was not just kind of like, oh yeah, follow me, kind of, but was saying, follow me and emulate me in everything that I do. Live like me. Be part of the way of Jesus. If we're willing to take that up and to follow him truly, I believe we can see amazing things happen. We can see people come to know the life and freedom that is in Jesus, the same way that our friends in India are experiencing. I believe that where there is injustice and oppression, there is a call of God to stand up and to fight for what is right, to stand up and to speak life, to tell those people that I believe that you bear the same fingerprint of God that I do, that I believe he breathed life into you the same way he did me, that we have equal value in this world. Are we willing? It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable. But a lot of who Jesus is and what he did is uncomfortable. We have to be willing to sacrifice, to lay down whatever it is, and be willing to take up this life that he's called us to. A life of justice. Micah 6:8. This is what the Lord requires of you. To love justice. To seek justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. How do we do that? How do we find a way to live in the way of Jesus? And I don't believe that every single person here, that it's going to look the same for each of you. The pastor of my church describes it like this. He says, we each have a spring of living water within us that God has placed there. My mom, she's turning 60 next Sunday. She heard the call of God maybe 6 years ago to start fostering fetal alcohol and drug addicted babies. 6 years ago, 54 years old, single mom, been through hell and back in her life. God said, this is my plan for you. And as Susie said, I have a 4-year-old sister. I had spent 20 years as an only child. And just last year, my mom adopted this little girl. And she has two other kids living with her at home. 3 kids, 60 years old, all under the age of 4. That's what it looks like in her. That's the spring of living water that God has placed there. For Susie and I, it looks a certain way. For you, it's going to look a certain way. But are we willing to be the light of the world? To be the salt and the light. Last story. Are we willing to draw out the God flavors and God colors in this world? See, salt, when you put it on your food, it draws the flavors out. The same way, that's what God is calling us to do, to be something. When we rub up against people, to draw out the flavors that God has already placed in them. See, we're all created by the same God. We all bear his fingerprint. Some people just don't realize that yet. It's in there. God has got a call for us, those who understand and have accepted and embraced Jesus, to be a part of living his kingdom out in all that we do. To be light. We have a responsibility, now that we have seen, to go and to find Jesus. Where he is moving, where he is working, to be part of the amazing things that he's doing around this world. And as Susie said, I want to thank you for your commitment to projects around the world, not just India. See, we're not about India. We are passionate about India, but we are more about and more passionate about Jesus and following Jesus and finding ways to inspire and encourage other followers of Jesus to be a part of that. So thank you for your commitment to things around this world, in your own community, Natalie, and whatever else you're doing in your own Tawasin area. We thank you for that and encourage you. Continue to be diligent, to love and care for those who are hurting, and to find Jesus in those moments. Keep praying for the Dalits, amazingly beautiful people. They need our prayers, they need our help, but we need them too. They have lots to teach us. And we're learning fast. We're going to show a little video, and then I think we're going to move on to the Lord's table. So thank you for listening. God bless you guys, and really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. So enjoy this last little video. I'll explain it quickly before we press play. This is a group of orphaned or abandoned girls who are living in a hostel that's connected to one of our schools. These girls have either been abandoned by their parents because they didn't want to have a girl child, or parents have died or left, or left with one parent and that parent couldn't look after them. A number of different stories. But are now being given the opportunity to go to school, an English medium school, be educated. And this is a worship song that they wrote in their own language, in Tamil. And a beautiful song and beautiful kids. So enjoy the song. Thank you.